You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
I got very close to Andrei Sakharov, who interestingly was the first man who ever hugged me when I said goodbye to him. He was such a great man, one of the great men of the 20th century. I remember I still remember the feel of his stubble on my cheek as I said goodbye to him. And I think we were both sort of in tears. I got very close to him, kind of father-son relationship. Weird, eh? The father of the Soviet hydrogen bomb.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com. Mark Brain studied in Moscow between 1971 and 1972, traveling the country with fellow UK students and spending silly amounts of time in the bathhouses with salted fish and very poor quality beer. He returned in 1974 to 75 as a Reuters trainee journalist, where he became very close to Andrei Sakharov, the father of the Soviet hydrogen bomb and noble Soviet-era dissident. East Berlin was his first solo posting for Reuters, where he and his wife Jutta both sang in the East Berlin Cathedral Choir for 4 years, including two as BBC Berlin with the honorary status of Lieutenant Colonel in the British Army. If you're enjoying the podcast, please leave written reviews in Apple Podcasts or share us on social media. By telling your friends, you can really help the podcast grow. If you can spare it, I'm asking listeners to contribute $3 per month to help keep us on the air. Larger amounts are welcome too. Plus, you get that sought-after Cold War Conversations coaster as a monthly financial supporter, and you bask in the warm glow of knowing that you are helping preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate. So, back to today's episode. This is part one of 3 episodes with Mark, and I'm sure you will find his stories equally interesting as I did. We welcome Mark to our Cold War conversation.
I can't remember how it was I came across your podcast, but certainly as I began to listen to it and get a sense of what you were doing and the openness with which you were exploring all manner of experiences related to the Cold War, and I sort of read it for a while, and eventually I thought, oh blimey, actually maybe I need to get in touch with you and release some of this stuff that I've been sitting on all this time.
Well, and then when you sent me your let's call it resume of experience, you were a must-have interviewee.
Yes, it was rather sweet. You replied. I said, might you be interested in the following? And I think you came back with a sort of duh version of what do you mean? Might I be?
Yeah. Yeah. Just hang on a minute, please.
Yeah. Would it be worth just, you know, in 3 or 4 sentences, which usually turn into about 3 or 14 or 40, I'll keep it short. A very quick dash through my engagement with the communist world and the Cold War, just a few headlines.
Yeah, sure.
It's a bit bonkers, really. It sort of goes back to my mother being a teacher of German. She came back from Australia, being evacuated to Australia in the Second World War, and studied German and French at Oxford. So she was passionate about languages. And I grew up with Germans visiting in the house on the North Norfolk coast, sort of every summer. And I got very interested in German and started going to Germany. My mum sent me to Germany in the Easter holidays every year through the mid-60s. And I actually turned out to be really rather good at languages, as in crazily good. And I just soaked them up. And I then spent over half a year in Germany between school and university, going on to study German and Russian at university. I did German and French at A-level, but I had a terrible French teacher, so I decided to do something else, another language. But my mum was really keen on Russian. She studied Russian and never learned any of it for her entire life, even when she had Alzheimer's. You know, she was still studying Russian 6 years ago.
Wow.
When I moved back to my hometown in Sheringham. So I developed this passion for languages really early on and discovered I was very good at them. Visited East Berlin. My first visit to East Berlin was in 1970, so that was my first exposure. 1968, of course, I went to Berlin. That was my first exposure to East Berlin, and it was pretty down at heel, but they were building the TV tower at the time. And I remember being sort of quite discombobulated, weird experience with the smell of brown coal smoke and Trabants and things. And then I studied German and Russian at university. Went to Russia for the first time in the summer of 1970 with all of our fellow students of Russian from Leeds University. Had the best part of 4 to 6 weeks, I think, in Russia. Went out by boat, the MS Estonia to Leningrad, and then down to Moscow to Abramtseva outside Moscow, where we sort of studied Russian. I got quite good at Russian as well, and then had a year in Moscow at the university, at MGU, the Moskovsky Gosudarstvenny Universitet, Moscow State University. And I was there for 10 months through 71, 72. Got there before he threw out all the Russian diplomats. But we managed to survive and stayed on there. Then I graduated in 73, having had a term in East Germany as well, in Leipzig, at Leipzig University in the summer of 1971. And I developed a lot of East German friends at that time. And I remember also going back a little bit, 68, working in Bamberg in West Germany, quite close to the Czech border. I remember Dubček, you know, the whole Czech.
Prague Spring.
Whole Prague Spring, because I was just over the border in Germany and they were following it so closely. And there was we were inspired, you know, I was only 18 at the time, but there was this sense of liberation. And I remember being in Paris, hitchhiking around Europe when the troops went on August 21st, 1968, and the crowds shouting "Dubček Svoboda," "Dubček Svoboda," Dubček, the Communist Party leader at the time, and Svoboda, the president. So I was sort of steeped in Eastern Europe fairly early on, and then went out to Moscow with Reuters, got a graduate trainee post with Reuters in 73, and spent my first 2 year posting with Reuters in Moscow, where I got very close to Andrei Sakharov, who interestingly was the first man who ever hugged me when I said goodbye to him in November 1975. I actually loved Sakharov. He was such a great man, one of the great men of the 20th century, and he was an important person in my journey towards psychotherapy. Interestingly, Ian, that was the
yeah.
I remember it's sort of, I still remember the feel of his stubble on my cheek as I said goodbye to him. And I think we were both sort of in tears. I got very close to him, kind of father-son relationship. Weird, eh? The father of the Soviet hydrogen bomb. Anyway, that's how I got going. So perhaps, you know, ask me another question. Otherwise,
yeah, no, well, hour. I mean, that would be a full episode, just what we've covered there. But if we just go back to that first time you visited East Berlin, I mean, you mentioned that the TV tower was going up. What was East Berlin like at that time?
I've got photographs that I took at the time, slides, color slides that I've digitized. I wish I could let you have a couple perhaps to put on there.
But I think you did share some links.
Feel free to post any of those on the website.
Well, they're amazing photos.
They are amazing photos, aren't they?
Yeah.
East Berlin was, the TV tower in East Berlin, curiously, I think was a bit of a triumph. And it's now, you know, the Warenzeichen, it's the trademark for Berlin. And it's one of the very few things of East Germany, of the GDR, that survived and has kind of nobility. And it was well designed and well built, you know, not like much of the other stuff that the East German authorities were putting up. East Berlin was still very much a kind of desert. There were huge bomb sites along Karl Marx Allee, just behind the facades of Karl Marx Allee in near the center. And of course, the whole of the center of East Berlin was torn down and rebuilt around the Alexanderplatz. and the station and the Marienkirche, the St. Mary's Church. They completely erased it in the Palace of the Republic. And the interesting thing, I think, about East Germany was how I got the sense at the time that they just didn't know what to do with the past. So they sort of erased it here and tried to preserve it there. And I remember going to Dresden for the first time in the summer of 71 when I was studying in inverted commas in Leipzig and just speaking lots of German and making very good friends and rowing with the Karl Marx University Rowing Club and making friends that I'm still friends with literally to this day, you know, very nearly 50 years on.
That must be great, saying that I, you know, there's people who say they row for Cambridge or Oxford. And I rowed with the Karl Marx University Rowing Club.
I did. And one of my dearest friends, Jürgen Gutsfeld, who's still very much a close friend, he actually rowed at Henley in 1967 with an East German crew that came over in eight. And they won a race in Henley, you know, time when the East Germans were trying to get international recognition.
Wow. So little known piece of East German sporting excellence there.
Genuine excellence. And these were not drugged up. I mean, Jürgen was not one of them. But he became an architect of building sports venues later on in life and became a very successful architect in Leipzig after the Wende, after 1989. But just remembering in Leipzig, we would row on the River Pleiße, which goes through the center of Leipzig, which rhymes with another word, German word, Scheiße, which listeners who speak German will know what that means.
Yep.
A bit of a sort of swear word. And it was full of brown coal effluent from just up the road and also from Buna, the Leunawerke, the chemical works upstream. Mm. And the East Germans used the rivers at the time just as sewers, really. I mean, it was just extraordinary. The water was black. And do you know what, Ian? To this day, 49 years on, I can remember the smell of those rivers through Leipzig. And going to Leipzig, I've visited Leipzig a few times since reunification. The joy that I get going to Leipzig, visiting my friends, seeing this vibrant city full of class and color and music and Bach and cleanliness and inspiration, and thinking back to how sad it was in those days. They were good people. I think the thing that I take from Eastern Europe, you know, not just my student time in East Germany, is just how ordinary people were. I mean, just ordinary friendships, ordinary life, ordinary love, ordinary families falling out, people going for picnics. And I loved living in Eastern Europe. And I used to actually say that the better Germans are the East Germans, although I ended up marrying a West German who I met in Moscow in 1974. There was a quality of life, Ian, in Eastern Europe where people used to really care for each other. They used to call it in German, die Solidarität der Schlangenstehenden, the solidarity of those who have to stand in line and queue up for things. And I used to find that in Russia too, during my 2 years in Moscow, 1974 to 75. I made some very good Russian friends. I'm sure they were reporting, some of them were reporting back to the KGB, but I remember warmly skiing in the outskirts of Moscow at minus 30 degrees, you know, in days when there were still decent winters, and going to the Russian bathhouses and eating salted herring and what they used to call it, vorbler, I think it used to call it, and terrible Russian beer. My goodness me, the Russians have improved their beer brewing skills. It was dreadful stuff, Zhiguli.
Yeah,
beer in the early 70s.
I'm glad you pronounced that. I would have got that completely wrong.
ZH. Well, it became a car, of course. The beer was Zhiguli, and then the Zhiguli became the larder. So there was a kind of tenderness and a warmth of people who relied on each other in real existing socialism. And so I made some fabulous friends, and I still, you know, draw on those. My wife and I draw on those to this day. And East Berlin, I mentioned in my list, one of my warmest memories from all of my years of living abroad and being a journalist, was singing in the East Berlin Cathedral Choir for 4 years, 2 years as a Reuters correspondent in East Berlin and 2 years as BBC correspondent in West Berlin. And it was bloody good choir.
I'm sure it was. That intrigued me. I mean, how did you get to join a cathedral choir in East Berlin?
It's a funny old life. My second wife, we might get round to that, left me with this wonderful legacy that when things are a bit weird, you just say it's a funny old life. You just had, that was the only way you could survive Eastern Europe, by saying, blimey, it's a funny old life. And not that my second wife was around at that time. But looking back, I went to East Berlin after my 2 years, best part of 2 years in Moscow, in the what was then a large Reuters bureau, when there were three or four people. I mean, now Reuters probably has about 70 people in Moscow. Reuters changed so much and became an economic powerhouse, I mean, an agency after I left in 1978. But in East Berlin, when I arrived as Reuters correspondent at the beginning of 1977, it was quite a sort of prestigious first solo posting for a young thrusting journalist, you know, trying to make his mark. And so I was very flattered to be offered that post. But I was not a terribly happy bunny as a young man, to put it mildly. And that's one of the reasons I later became a psychotherapist, you know, divorced parents and boarding school, the usual sort of English story. And I was sitting in the Reuter flat in the Schönhauser Allee in January 1977, feeling pretty sorry for myself, to be honest, out of my depth, just not certain how I was going to sort of hack this one. And Jutta, my then fiancé, was in England. So I was all on my rather miserable alone in the Reuter flat. And I heard church bells on a Sunday morning. And they were coming from one of those extraordinary churches that the Germans have from the late 19th century, from the Gründerzeit, from the Victorian era, what we would call the Victorian era, where the churches are built into the tenement buildings. So there was a church straight opposite the Reuter bureau. And of course, the church in East Germany was vibrant. The Protestant church had a kind of vibrancy. It was a kind of official underground. And I thought, blimey, I'm not a Christian. I mean, I'm not a religious person, really. Although I do love church music. So I beetled across, hoping just to sort of meet people, and went through the service and got talking to the pastor at the end of the service. And he was really nice. Herbert Hildebrandt was his name. And he was the brother-in-law of Regina Hildebrandt, who went on to become one of United Germany's most popular politicians with the SPD. So I got talking with Herbert. And I said, you know, I was already loved singing. I was a choral singer. And he said, well, why did you come and join our choir? Domkantorei, the cathedral choir. So although the cathedral was still in ruins, we rehearsed every Monday evening at a venue in East Berlin. And I started going to that choir and singing bass. And Jutta, my very soon wife, she came, by the way, over to Berlin and was switching from Bonn to West Berlin as a teacher training. And in order to switch, she had to give a good reason for switching universities in Germany. And she said, well, I'm my fiance is Reuters correspondent in East Berlin. They said, what do you mean fiance? Anybody can say that. When are you getting married? She said, 6 weeks, next month. So she rang me and she said that, Mark, I've just said we're getting married. Do you mind?
That's what I call a proposal.
That was a great proposal. We then divorced in 2000 and remarried in 2013, but that's another story. But so we married in the Wieskirche in Bavaria, which is one of Germany's most famous churches. It's another story, Ian. Sorry, there's so many stories.
And don't worry. Just keep going. I'm riveted.
The Wieskirche, the church in the meadow, is one of Germany's most famous, one of Europe's most famous sort of rural churches. Beautiful Rococo church, and it's Catholic. And my Jutta was a lapsed Catholic, so she had to rejoin the church, and we had a few discussions with the vicar, and we were married then in that church. And they said on a Saturday afternoon, don't worry, there won't be too many tourists. And so we were married. We turned around from the altar and the church was packed with tourists. I'll never forget the moment, dear, oh dear. Anyway, so we married and Jutta then sang with me in the cathedral choir in East Berlin. And we just carried on singing in that choir every Monday evening for the next 4 years with the Hildebrandts, Jörg Hildebrandt being Regina's husband. And he's still alive. Herbert just recently died, very sadly. And he was the cantor, the choir master. Right. And he, fascinatingly, had been the choir master. He'd founded the choir in the Erlöserkirche, the Church of Our Savior, which is the very famous church on the Bernauer Straße, right in the heart of Berlin, where the wall went.
Oh, the one that got blown up.
the one that got blown up, Ian. Yep.
Wow.
And the wall went right past its front door, and it was in no man's land from 61 through to when they blew it up in 85 or so. So the choir used to rehearse there before the wall went up, but then Herbert Hildebrandt was determined to keep the choir going as a as an all Berlin institution. It became then just obviously East Berlin, but it was a kind of leftover. He honored the memory of United Berlin by keeping that choir going all the way through East Germany. And there were we, Reuter correspondent, then BBC correspondent, singing away, you know, Bach's Christmas Oratorio and the Messiah and the Matthew Passion and the John Passion. We used to do wonderful concerts. God, it was a good choir in the Gethsemane Kirche, the Gethsemane Church in East Berlin, which of course in 88-89 became the center of the revolution.
Yeah,
which
that's
brought
right.
down the wall. So, you know, crazy. And the fascinating thing, we'll get to my Stasi files, but Stasi never clocked really that I was singing in the choir. And, Ian, you know, the Stasi, they make me laugh if they don't make you cry. They are just like journalists in those days before the days of the internet. They would cut and paste from the last year's report. And in my files, there's a report about the end of my first year in East Berlin where they have a kind of end of term report. We'll come back to that. It's rather fun. And they said, Brain, who my Deckname, my name in the Stasi files was Martin, because they gave a name for everybody, obviously.
Yeah, yeah. So your code name was Martin.
My code name was Martin, yeah. So Martin sings in the, and they said, the choir of St. Mary's Church. It was pretty obvious. It was the choir of the cathedral, excuse me. But
yeah.
That mistake was then copied through all the subsequent reports for the rest of my time. While I had anything to do with East Germany. Right, I'm going to pause for a moment and let you ask a question.
No, that's fine. That's fine. I really appreciate you sharing those. So in East Berlin as a Reuters correspondent, who were you speaking to in East Germany to get your pieces?
There wasn't a lot of official information coming out. So obviously, one had to read Neues Deutschland carefully and the press. It was a bit like Moscow in that regard. You know, there was no official information. It was just the facade and all the party, you know, rubbish that was coming out. But you had to follow all that stuff. The comings and goings and foreign policy, because East Germans were quite big in Africa and places. And, you know, we had to sort of follow it pretty closely. And, you know, in military strategic terms, obviously, they were very, very important in the East-West standoff. So there was a lot to cover in terms of geopolitics and Cold War and the relations between East and West Germany, because it was the era of Willy Brandt, Helmut Schmidt, really, I think, was chancellor at the time. And the Ostpolitik, the Annäherung, the getting closer to East, you know, of the two Germanies, was a very important part of what we were doing, what we were reporting. So I was the only, Reuters was the only Western, big Western news agency, non-German, that had a bureau in East Berlin at the time, which actually went back to 1959 and had been opened up because Reuters had a whole load of money in East Germany, which was in non-convertible East German marks. So they had to do something with it. And in 1959, they thought, well, why don't we open a...
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Why don't we open a bureau? So they used the stash. Did anybody tell you the story about Freddie Forsyth, Ian?
I've heard it, but some of my listeners might not have done.
Who was one of my illustrious predecessors as correspondent in East Berlin. And the flat on the Schönhauser Allee was the Reuter office and flat from 59, from the beginning. And it was on the main route in and out of Karl-Marx-Allee in the center of town. So whenever there was a military parade, the tanks would come that way. And I watched Castro go past our window. And Sigmund Jähn, the first German astronaut or cosmonaut who went up with the Russians. He went past on a big sort of motorcade thing standing in the back of an open car. And Freddie Forsyth, you know, better novelist than he was a journalist. And in just after the wall went up in 61, he was the Reuters correspondent in East Berlin. And in the middle of the night, there was this tremendous roaring of tanks outside the Reuters flat window. So Freddie Forsyth, this is the story that's been told to me. I'm sure Freddie Forsyth would tell a slightly less self-culpatory story. But he then observed all these tanks barreling towards the center of town and put out a flash on the Reuters newswire saying basically, you know, the Russians are about to invade West Berlin. And it was October the 10th, you know, it was the East German military, you know, day of the founding of the Republic. And all they were doing was just trundling down to the middle of the town to run up and down and look serious and bast some diesel fumes all over the place and then trundle back out again, which they promptly did about 2 hours later. So Reuters had to rewind the story. I think shortly afterwards, Freddie Forsyth quit Reuters or was quit. Gegangen, as the Germans say, he was gone as a kind of transitive verb. And he went to Africa and became a much better novelist than he was ever a journalist.
Because one of my previous episodes, I interviewed Peter Miller.
Oh, Peter Miller. Good grief, Peter Miller.
Yeah.
He wrote many books.
Yes. And he was obviously Reuters as well Berlin. And he talks about the Stasi trying a honey trap on him.
Okay.
Did you have any such experiences?
No, I didn't. Well, I was just newly married, so they were quite respectful. And
I think that's how he got rid of them as well, actually.
Marrying strategically.
Yeah.
No honey traps. No, you asked who did I talk to? You know, there was a lot of expatriate chattering going on at dinner, at cocktail parties, dinner parties with Western diplomats. I was very close to the Ständige Vertretung, the West German mission in East Berlin, and to the British Embassy, the American Embassy. We all traded information to the best of our abilities, just like I'd done in Moscow. There was a kind of information bartering going on all the time about what on earth was going on. But my edge in East Berlin, and then when I was reporting from West Berlin in German a lot, because I broadcast for the German service of the BBC in German, as well as reporting into the English language, World Service and Radio 4 and stuff. My edge, if you like, was because I was sort of just living an ordinary life among ordinary East Germans, and I just picked up all kinds of stuff that was going on with the help of Edmund Greisbirnd, who was our office manager. And the extraordinary thing, she'd been with Reuters. She's unfortunately died about 10 years ago, but she was with Reuters from the beginning as the office manager and secretary and sort of just dog's body and do everything. Fix everything. And she was never a Stasi agent. Really interesting. She came from the Dienstleistungsbüro, the official source of all workers. You know, you couldn't hire anybody just on the open market in East Germany or anywhere in Eastern Europe. You had to get it through the official sort of state enterprise for translators and cooks and bottle washers and stuff. And Ed Mutter came to us that way. But when the files were all open, she was a woman of great integrity. She was a product of her system, you know, lived in East Germany, so she wasn't disloyal. But my goodness me, she was a good source. She was a good woman. So she used to pick up a lot and say she couldn't report it because she wasn't a reporter and wasn't allowed to report. But she said, Mark, you might want to check this out or check that out. And I talked to my friends. And one of my scoops was when the East Germans bought 10,000 Golfs, VW Golfs from West Germany. And it was a kind of acknowledgement that the Golf was a rather better car than the Trabant. It was one of those moments that led actually ultimately to the collapse of East Germany. And I got an insight on that because somebody said, guess what? Golfs are being delivered to a car showroom down near Schönefeld Airport. So I beetled out with my friends. And sure enough, there they were. So I put that on the Reuters wire, especially in Germany. It was a sensation. It was one of my great scoops.
I presume it was only party loyalists who would have got them.
No. The curious thing about East Germany was they used to insist that they were a law-based state. And when I go through my Stasi files, all 2,700 pages of them, it's clear that the Stasi was quite particular about putting down, we're opening a formal legal proceedings against Martin, you know, Brain Mark, whatever, for anti-socialist, whatever, you know, according to so-and-so of the law. So they, it was a very bureaucratic state that sort of, it wasn't pure Willkür. What's the English for Willkür? Sort of whim. There were rules, and there were people in East Germany who supported and managed the system, who were sort of trying to do the right thing by the rules of the state. So when 10,000 Golfs were imported, I'm sure there were an awful lot of party loyalists who got first dibs. But there were quite a lot of very ordinary people who just managed to get themselves in the queue, and or with connections, you know, Beziehung, vitamin B, they used to call it.
Yeah.
You know, connections. We'd call it vitamin C, I guess, with connections. So it wasn't entirely meritocratic, but there were, you know, a lot of people got Golfs who had just been in the queue for a long time.
That's incredible.
Yeah. A 10-year wait for cars, of course.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Did you interview any of the East German politicians at all or not?
That reminds me of in China, when I was in China in the mid-80s, the Today program would occasionally ring and say, can you ring Deng Xiaoping's office to see whether we can get an interview? I mean, the answer was, duh. No, never. Not once. Not in East Germany. Not a single interview did I ever get with anybody in any position of authority. I'd say the most powerful interview I ever did with any well-known East German, the interview of which I'm most proud, which was on the Today program in the 8:10 slot, you know, the top of the program.
Yeah.
Was March 1990 from the Palace of the Republic, where very late at night, when it was clear that the CDU were sweeping the polls with a vote for unification, where I interviewed Stefan Heim, who was kind of dissident novelist, novelist who came back to East Germany from spending the war years in America. And I was sort of close. I thought Heim was going to be my sort of Sakharov, but he wasn't a kind of clearinghouse for dissident information. But I sort of got a bit close to Stefan Heim while I was there with Reuters, and he used me because his son was the same height as me, you know, 6'4". And so he used me to bring suits over from West Berlin for his son. Which we traded for information, except he never really gave me any. But I finally got my payback, Ian, in March 1990. The election results were pouring in and the CDU was winning. And I went up to Heim because he was in the restaurant of the Palace of the Republic, which was the press center for this. And I said, you know, Stefan, could you give me an interview in English? Because obviously his English was fluent. And I asked him, you know, one of the questions I asked him was, so what do you think historians will say about this GDR that's now going to reunify? And he said, oh, it'll just be a footnote in history. And that was on the Today program at 8:10. I was quite proud of that. But otherwise, interviews with, you know, no, absolutely not.
You did mention in the notes that you sent me about an incident in 1977. Where you almost got
chucked out.
Yes.
Yes. That was an interesting one. One of the reasons that I was quite glad to stop being a journalist, Ian, was that I managed to be in the wrong place at the wrong time most of the time. And I missed so many stories by being on leave or away or in the wrong place. And I left China at the end of May 1989. 4 or 5 days before the tanks went onto Tiananmen Square. It was rather clever timing. And my honeymoon in 1977 was in Grenada in the Caribbean. And so my relatively new wife and I we hadn't yet come back from our honeymoon in the Caribbean. So on the 7th of October, as Jutta and I were preparing to come back from the Caribbean, there was a cravalle. There was a commotion on Alexanderplatz, where the police went in to break up some youths who were getting a bit boisterous on the national holiday. And I got back to East Berlin. That was on the weekend. And I got back to East Berlin, I think, on the Tuesday or the Wednesday. And the place was buzzing with rumors that some policemen had died in this sort of riot. It wasn't a massive riot, but it was sort of poll tax sort of thing. And Edmuta and her friends and my stand-in, Derek Parr at the time, who was standing in for me while I was away, they'd heard from friends at the Charité at the hospital that there had been deaths and possibly four policemen had died. Now, I had no corroborating source. It was no point in talking to the officialdom because they would deny it. You know, they wouldn't talk to us.
Yeah.
So I put the story out over my name because we couldn't put it over Ed Mutter's name. And Derek was already leaving, Derek Parr. So it went over my name, and the East German authorities were pretty miffed. And they said it was, you know, anti-socialist slander, and it was untrue and all the rest of it. And they hauled me into the foreign ministry and gave me a very sharp dressing down. And said, Herr Brain, das ist unserious. Mr. Brain, that is unserious. You know, for me, age 27, that was pretty frightening to be told.
Unserious.
Unserious. Not much worse than that. So we negotiated a kind of climb down where Reuters put out a statement. To this day, Ian, I'm not absolutely certain whether anybody died. I suspect they didn't. I suspect it was what the Germans call a Falschmeldung, you know, a false fake news. Falschmeldung. So the East Germans invented the term fake news. We'd know by now.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, it's interesting. It's almost a bit like one of the sort of incidents that kicked off the Velvet Revolution to some degree was that, you know, there was talk of a student being killed by the police.
Which wasn't true. That's right.
Which wasn't true, but sort of grew in its... in its telling.
Well, these things gain a currency, and they gain a currency because the political system is such that it can't digest this. The rumors and the failure, the inability of the state to level up with its citizens leaks out sideways. Even so, the relatively small thing, you know, it can happen. Hey, you can have riots and policemen can come to grief. This happens in any state, but it reflected just how dysfunctional that state was and how it rested actually on sand, as we discovered, you know, just a little over 10 years later. But they didn't throw me out. But if I'd been West German, absolutely they would have kicked me out. They would have made a great hullabaloo, and that would have been the end of my time in East Germany. But because I was Reuters, English and British, it would have caused too many problems to throw me out. So, but it didn't do me any harm. Really, you know, we trundled on. We didn't have any access to official information anyway, so they couldn't withhold anything that they weren't already withholding.
Well, I guess it sounds good on your CV to say that you were unserious, or
well,
you made the East Germans think you were unserious.
It was preparation. I don't know if I put it on my list of things that we might talk about, Ian, but it was preparation for being declared persona non grata in Romania. A little while later.
We have got that, and we will come to that. We will come to that. So many stories here. Mark, you know, I need a larger hard disk to cater for all of this, because you returned to Berlin with the BBC.
Well, I didn't so much return to Berlin.
You
I
just switched.
Berlin. I just defected from East Berlin to West Berlin. With a 3 month gap in the middle to sort of learn BBC World Service stuff and be reprogrammed for reporting in German on radio rather than in English to a news agency, to a global news agency. So I spent three months at the end of 78, beginning of 79 with the German service at Busch House and the World Service.
And how different did you find working for the BBC versus Reuters? How different was that?
I love radio. I love sound. It's one of the reasons I love your podcast. And I took to radio like a duck to water. There's something about the communication, the direct sense of one person talking to one person. I mean, in radio, you're not broadcasting to millions, although I did, from China. There were probably times when I was broadcasting to hundreds of millions at once, especially when I was singing Barbershop on Chinese television on a Sunday morning. You might come to that on another.
No, you didn't note that down. I'm writing that one down.
But there was an intimacy to radio. You know, radio has the best pictures, as is well known. And there was.
I haven't heard that line. I'm having that. I'm having that.
No, radio has the best pictures because they're created by the individual listeners. So you are not broadcasting to a group. You are talking to one person. So I could be talking. You know, you're listening in, and others will hear this recording. But reporting on the radio to BBC World Service, I was only ever reporting to one person. And it gave it a kind of an immediacy and a need to explain and communicate and use words and structure, sentence structure that would stay with people. And it's not a printed form. There's such a difference between writing for radio, because it was written, you know, the dispatches were written. They weren't made up on the spot. The two ways obviously were spontaneous as this one is. But when you write for radio, you know, on a typewriter, as we had typewriters, God, I was glad when word processing came in because I used to change everything. But when you're writing on a typewriter, even though you're writing, you're talking into your typewriter. So I loved that. And I loved the sense of hearing the voice come back, you know, in German. Once a week I did a letter from Berlin, Brief aus Berlin, which was listened to avidly by our relatively small audience of BBC listeners in East Germany, especially in East Berlin, because we broadcast on FM, on VHF, as we, I think, called it in those days, into East Berlin. So we had quite a loyal set of listeners. And I think the BBC German service was part of the story that led to November 1989. And, you know, we correspondents for the German service, young English men mainly, you know, with fluent German, we played our small part in bringing that about. But the biggest difference, I think, was sort of a curious difference from a Cold War perspective, was that in East Berlin, I was an accredited correspondent, you know, with a formal accreditation with the Foreign Ministry, that dreadful building, which thank goodness they've pulled down. Now they're putting the new palace up in old East Berlin. Whereas when I went to West Berlin to the BBC, I was an honorary member of the British military government. I was an honorary lieutenant colonel. So I had the status, the BBC had the status in West Berlin of a military correspondent. Because nothing had changed in Berlin, in four power Berlin, the four sectors, from May the 8th, May the 9th, 1945, until the signing and implementation of the 4+2 negotiations in 1990 and reunification, nothing changed in Berlin because the Russians and the West, you know, the Soviets, as we, you know, correctly need to call them.
So you could waltz through Checkpoint Charlie just showing your ID card.
I waltzed through Checkpoint Charlie showing my orange card. And of course, when Jutta, my wife, when we went to West Berlin, she had German citizenship, but she didn't at that point have British citizenship, but she couldn't have an orange card as a German citizen. Otherwise, she'd be her own occupier. So she had to take British citizenship. So being German, she got her passport and took it on board at the British consulate in West Berlin. And she had to swear allegiance, you know, as one does, you know, on the hand on the Bible stuff. And she swore allegiance, and we laugh about it to this day, to the Queen and all her heirs, because heirs is written with an H, you know,
yeah.
In German, you pronounce every letter. So to the Queen and all her heirs. So she then became dual citizenship, German and British. And then we went into East Berlin showing our orange card just through the window of the car, because we were visiting not the Hauptstadt der DDR, not the capital of the German Democratic Republic, but the Soviet sector of occupation of occupied Berlin.
Yeah.
And so the BBC status, we lived in a British military house, rather nice one actually, in West Berlin for 2 years.
Yeah.
So we had access, but we couldn't go outside East Berlin, couldn't go outside the Soviet sector, except through Starken, through the checkpoint out of West Berlin into the Soviet zone. And then when we were in the Soviet zone, that was the German Democratic Republic. So I had to have a visa. I mean, you couldn't make this stuff up anymore, could you? Because Berlin was just bonkers.
Yeah. Well, I've heard the term Berlinology.
Yeah.
With diplomats who were experts in Berlinology and knew all the nuances of the, you know, the post-war agreement and exactly how it worked and all the different protocols.
A bit like the Irish backstop.
Yeah.
Nothing changes.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's really interesting. So, well, that must have been nice to be a lieutenant colonel. Did that come with any other benefits?
I have to, you know, were there any honey traps set by the East Germans or the KGB, you know, my time in Eastern Europe? You know, the question don't know if you're going to ask it, but I'll answer it now anyway, is was I ever approached by Western secret services? And the answer is no, not really. We worked very closely with Bricksmiths, the British military mission to the Soviet zone, and they were legal spies. They would travel around East Germany and break into Soviet military bases and climb into tanks and take photographs and stuff. And it was a bit of a sort of boy's own competition between the Russians and the Western zones and the Brits and the Americans and the French, especially the Brits, because they really, it was a very public school. They would have a marvelous time taking down the signs that the Russians, the Soviets put up around the areas where they didn't want the Bricksmith people to go. So we were quite close to the Bricksmith lot. And I'll just tell you a story. I think it was on my list. One of my favorite stories, and I've got a picture of it out here. In East Germany, so much of East Germany was off limits as military testing grounds and so on. I mean, huge swathes of East Germany were military for the Russians or for the East Germans, mainly for the Russians. And so the Russians would put these signs up, as I'm sure you've discussed in previous podcasts, around all of their military bases to try and sort of keep these Western spies away. And they were four languages, you know, no entry in German, in Russian, in French, and in English.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War, because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
No access to members of military missions, you know, from, and so the Soviets kept putting these things up, but the Brits and Bricksmith kept pulling them down and saying you're not allowed to have them up, and also that's not a legitimate area. So Bricksmith would go and nick these signs, just, you know, in industrial quantities, and the Soviets kept putting the signs back up. And one day, a very dear Australian diplomat friend of mine, she was number two at the Australian mission in East Berlin. And she was a very good source for some of the diplomatic stuff. Still a very good friend, now living in Perth. She was very close to all this military lot, and probably she might have been Australian intelligence as well. I've never asked her, actually. I need to do that this summer when we go over to Australia. But she had one of these signs, which had been given to her by Charlie. I can't remember Charlie, Major Charlie with Bricksmith. And she had a sign in her house in East Berlin, because she was a diplomat in East Berlin. And I said to Charlie and Sue, when they came around for dinner, because we used to do lots of entertaining in our Type 4 house in Johannesburg, Ali in West Berlin, in 79 to 81, I said to him, God, I'd like one of those signs. And Charles sort of looked wisely and stroked his beard and said, stroked his chin and said, well, I can't really, I'm not allowed to nick these things for, you know, because you're not one of us. You know, you're a journalist. I can't really do that. You're not a diplomat. You're not military, but I tell you what, I can write you a thank you letter. Oh, I said, that's really kind of you, thinking, hello, he's going to play around with this one. Anyway, we got the thank you letter. And the thank you letter was written on the back of one of these signs.
Brilliant.
And the sign, I mean, I've got it literally outside my study here, where I'm talking to you now, and it's, dear Mark, thank you so much for a lovely evening. Delightful. Nice to meet your little son. Such a splendid little chap who'd been born. He was only 3 months old at the time, our firstborn.
Right.
You know, and it's a bit of an unusual letterhead and paper, but I hope you like it. So I've had that ever since. I was going to take it to Antiques Roadshow to see what it was worth, but they were on Cromer Pier the other day, but I was traveling at the time, so I wasn't able to take it along. It is the most extraordinary Cold War memento.
I've actually seen one of these. One of the talks I do at various societies is about Bricksmiths.
Oh, okay.
And it's made up of a number of recordings I did of an interview with a Bricksmith officer. And he tells the most incredible stories. But I regularly get former Bricksmith personnel turning up to these talks, and they bring along one of these signs.
But I bet not many have got a thank you letter for a dinner party on the back.
Not at all. Not, I haven't checked the back of it.
It's written in code, you know.
Yeah. Another incredible story. So your wife was, I think you said she had to commute to the West to get to the Free University.
That's right. Because she came to join me, she was 2 years into a 3-year teacher training in Bonn, having not been allowed to do A-levels, you know, Abitur, and go to university by her very traditional father from Dresden, who was an army officer, or became an army officer working in the military, in the music corps of the Bundeswehr. He was very traditional in his attitude to women and boys. So Jutta wasn't able to study for Abitur, for A-levels, and go to university. But she started as a secretary in the Ministry for International Aid in Bonn in the late 60s, but wanted to become a teacher. So she got herself posted as a 21-year-old to Moscow as a secretary. And that was where I met her when I was with Reuters, arriving in Moscow in 74. So she then saved enough money from her German income, embassy income, to go back to Germany and study, self-funded study at the teacher's training college in Bonn, starting in 1975. And she was 2 years into a 3-year teacher training when I went back out to Bonn and met her again, and we sort of teamed up. And I then got posted to East Berlin. And if we were going to be together, she clearly needed to switch. So that's how we ended up getting married, rather quicker, in strange circumstances. But she moved to then East Berlin, but she was then studying at the Free University in what we wasn't then the Free University, it was the Pädagogische Hochschule, the teacher training college in West Berlin. So she would commute every day from East Berlin to West Berlin as a German citizen, not, of course, through Checkpoint Charlie, but through either Bonhomer Straße or Heinrich-Heine Straße, which were the crossing points for Germans, because Germans couldn't cross at Checkpoint Charlie. Checkpoint Charlie was there for non-German foreigners. Mm. So she beetled backwards and forwards with her four-stroke car, and would come back every evening and back to Schönhauser Allee. But rather unusual.
She must have been virtually on first name terms with the border guards, I would have thought.
It was weird. We sort of got to know them, but they would sort of smile wanly. Because I used to go backwards and forwards across Checkpoint Charlie a huge amount, especially to the Reuter Bureau in West Berlin, because we used to work very, very closely together. Obviously, the German service, Reuter Bureau, the Reuters German service, and Reuter Bureau in West Berlin, and me doing English for the whole of Berlin, really, on the east. We both go across the border almost every day, but we had these things called a Grenzempfehlung, a border recommendation, which allowed us to jump queues and go in. And I had a very fetching old-style British passport, which is sort of rather the vogue again now. And I remember that well, using it almost every day to go backwards and forwards across Checkpoint Charlie. While Jutta, when we were going backwards and forwards to East Berlin, when we were in West Berlin, then going, then we'd go over through Checkpoint Charlie because she had an orange card. But when we were going out to dinner in West Berlin from East Berlin, I would go through Checkpoint Charlie and she would have to go through Heinrich-Heine Straße just down the road, and we'd meet up on the other side to carry on to the dinner. And then coming back, we'd have to do the same, split and go through different checkpoints for 2 years.
Crazy, crazy times. And when you go to Berlin now, it's difficult to imagine it.
And I just a little aside, Ian, I so love Germany, and I take my hat off to how the Germans have healed those wounds. When Helmut Kohl said in 5 years there would be blühende Landschaften in East Germany, there will be blooming landscapes. I remember thinking he's right. It's going to be like that. But of course, it took slightly longer than had been hoped in 1989, 1990. But the Germans, as a nation and as a state, how they have risen to the challenge of integrating East Germany, building East Germany up, honoring East Germany in messy ways, and there are pockets of East Germany that are still suffering a lot, as we see with the AfD coming up again in Saxony. Yeah. But going to Leipzig, going to Dresden in particular, where my wife's father's first wife was died in the raid of February 1945, and his first daughter, Angelika, which is my wife's, which is our daughter's middle name, died of diphtheria in January 1945. So there's a real German history here that I've sort of married into, and that I feel in my bones that we, you know, trashed Dresden in 45, and the kind of grief of visiting Dresden when I was living in Germany and feeling the gaping emptiness of the Dresden city center and how it had been brutalized by the Pragerstrasse. These Germans had put up these dreadful new buildings, and how the rest of it was waiting sort of to be healed. It's like a sort of gaping wound. And as a psychotherapist, this is the stuff I work with emotionally all the time, you know, wounds of the past. Mm. And going to Dresden now, it just warms the heart, and how the Frauenkirche has been rebuilt with that British provided cross on the top. I mean, what a testament to the healing power of connection. And, you know, really hats off to the Germans.
Yeah. Yeah.
I get very sort of philosophical about that.
But no, I think it's interesting, the East German experience of the end of the Cold War, because West Germany was there. I know, you know, a lot of people lost their jobs, and it wasn't very, you know, it wasn't a great experience for a significant number of East Germans. But compared to somewhere like Bulgaria or Romania, with rampant inflation and loss of pensions and all of that sort of thing, there was a lot more of a cushioned transition for the East Germans.
Absolutely. I mean, they used what one might call, in monetary terms today, the big bazooka. They just printed money, and they pumped, the West Germans just opened up the hose pipes into East Germany. It was astonishing how quickly the place began to change.
Yeah.
And look at East Germany now. You really can't tell the difference, except in the quality of, there's something about the quality of relationships still. There's a kind of community spirit in East Germany. In Dresden, I remember cycling through on a tandem, because I do these crazy long distance cycle trips. We did the length of New Zealand, which is not so much to do with the Cold War, but a few years ago, and cycled from Berlin to Prague and then across to Bamberg on the tandem. Going through Dresden, there's a sense of sort of getting together at particular times of year and all swimming in the river at the same time. And the Elbe Schwimmen, you know, the Elbe swim, they called it, and they swim downstream. And there's a sense of getting together and being a community in East Germany. It's quite strong in West Germany as well, so stronger than it is in some ways in the UK. But there's something about the East German experience that has not gone. There's a kind of quality to identity. Weird.
Yeah,
difficult to put.
I wonder whether it's, you know, it's almost around a feeling of community facing the same adversity of shortages, yeah, and having to rely on other people to fix things for you, and that process of cooperation that you had to have with your neighbors and with your friends to just basically get through life.
Totally. But the thing that fascinates me with the psychology of all of this is just how deeply burned that was into the kind of collective and individual and family psyche in East Germany over the 40 years that East Germany existed. Yeah. And here we are 30 years later, and there's still an echo in the East Germany, in East Berlin as opposed to West Berlin, in Leipzig as opposed to Düsseldorf.
Yeah.
You know, there's something special. There's something different about East Germany, about the new federal lands, federal states, as they call them.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I wonder how long that will last, though.
The new generation, less so. Yeah.
Yeah, it must be ebbing away.
But it is the psychology that fascinates me, and that's one of the reasons that I am happy to have moved on from journalism into psychotherapy. But there is a kind of collective unconscious, what Carl Jung would call. There was something very big going on in the center of Europe, which was to do with the wounds of the Second World War, which couldn't heal, And the fall of the wall and the end of communist regimes across Eastern Europe was like it was a very deep psychological process, as well as a political and social and economic process. And the fascinating thing for me, very personally, is it coincided with a breakthrough and a breakdown in my own personal life when my marriage began to fall apart. But there was a kind of healing journey that began, and the Romanian Revolution was right at the heart. It's got a tipping point in my life, was actually at the end of 1989 in covering the Romanian Revolution.
And we have further photos, videos and information on this episode in our show notes, which will show as a link in your podcast app. Don't forget, if you'd like to get one of those Cold War Conversations coasters, help keep us on the air, then head over to coldwarconversations.com/donate. And if you can't wait for the next episode, do visit our Facebook discussion group where listeners just like you continue the Cold War conversation. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thank you very much for listening. It is really appreciated. Goodbye.
Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.